We're holding on Chaf Vav Amud Beis, the fourth line of the wide lines. The fifth line, rather. We're talking about Tashmishei Kedusha and Tashmishei Mitzvah, where we said Tashmishei Mitzvah are things where you use it for a mitzvah, but it itself doesn't have intrinsic Kedusha. For example, we said a sukkah, a lulav, etc., where in principle you're allowed to throw them away afterwards. So the minhag is that you don't, at least you don't treat them with desire. The sukkah, for example, it says you're not allowed to step on the schach, the arovus from the lulav also, you're not supposed to step on. People save their lulavim and use them to burn together with the chametz, but mi'ikra din, you're allowed to throw them out as long as you don't treat them with bizoy. On the other hand, we said tashmishei kedusha, things that are used for directly for items that have intrinsic kedusha. For example, we said cases for sfarim or bags for tefillin and things like that. Those and the ritzuris of tefillin, those have intrinsic kedusha, and those have to be put in shapes. So we talked about a few things where we said, for example, Rava had said that the paroiches he thought was tashmish to tashmish because it's serving the aron, which in turn is serving the sifrei Torah in it. So therefore, maybe he shouldn't have intrinsic kedusha. It should be like no different than the shul itself. But then he saw that sometimes they take the paroiches and wrap it and put the sefer Torah on it. So therefore, it's considered a tashmish kedusha nowadays. But they don't do that. In fact, it says in Shulchan Aruch that the paroiches only has the din of like the rest of the shul building, so it doesn't have the same degree of intrinsic kedusha. The paroiches in front of the aron, yeah, other things like that. So for Omar Rava, Hani Zvili de Chumashi. The Zvili of Chumashim, Rashi translates that Zvili is like we had before in the Gemara Jules. We had in the Gemara before, Jules Kenei Sfarim, which meant like cases, so like bags for Sfarim. So Rashi says that Zvili means something similar for Chumashim. Chumashim in those times, remember, were written like Sifrei Torah on scrolls, but individual Chumashim rather than all five together. The Aruch gives a different explanation that Zvili, the Chumashi, means sort of like a frame of the Aruch describes it as like a leather frame that they use to put around the sefer. Whatever the case, so it's some kind of case or cover for the sefer, the Kamtere de Sifri, and the boxes that they use, the boxes in which they put Sfarim. Tashmish kedusha ninu v'nignazim. So those are considered a tashmish kedusha. Therefore, when they wear out, you have to put them in shameless. You can't just use them for mundane purposes. So unless it's pshita, obviously, what else would you think they are if not tashmish kedusha? And the answer is ma'ud teima hani lav l'chavid avinan. You would think, without Rava telling you, maybe these things are not made for covered for the sefer l'naturi ba'alma avidi. They're really only made in order to protect the sefer. Kamash malon. Therefore, Rava is telling us that not. Now, you have two ways that Rishonim learn this answer of the Gemara. Are we saying that, in fact, it's incorrect to think that they're only for Shmira? They are, in fact, for covered, implying, therefore, that if you had something that was strictly for Shmira, then it wouldn't have to be put in Shemus, and you could use it for some other purpose. Or are we saying that, no, even if it's only for Shmira, nevertheless, you still need to put it in Shemus? A Nafkamina, for example, so the Urzarua, a Rishon, talks about what if you have, for example, so like you, in most shuls, you have the Oren Kodesh sticks out from the wall, like this one, and most other ones. But sometimes you have, for example, where there's a niche in the wall, there's like the wall itself is set back, and then you keep the Sefer Torah in there. So now, is that considered something that's only there in order to protect the Sfarim? So if you say, if you learn the Gemara as saying that where it's only there to protect them, then it doesn't have Kedusha, then it would mean such an Aron Kodesh does not have Kedusha. On the other hand, if you say that it does, then it does. So the Mishnah Berurah points out that if in that niche they build a fancy Aron Kodesh, then yeah, for sure that's for the covered of the Torah, and therefore that would have the din of a regular Aron Kodesh. But what if, in other words, like you just have a niche over there, and like you put the Sifrei Torah in there, and like you put a paroches in front of it or something?
What's that mean? I don't understand the differences. I don't understand. So what's the difference if it's inside or outside?
Because the difference is that if it's a niche in the wall, then it's not really. The niche was not necessarily made for the Sfarim, and even to the extent it is, it's not really for the covered of the Sfarim of the Sifrei Torah. It's just practically speaking, in order to guard them. So the Ramah brings that Urzarua and says that such a thing, in fact, would not have the Kedusha of an Oren Kodesh. So it would mean, in other words, that if eventually they renovate the shul, for example, and they take down the wood and the plaster and whatever that made up that niche, then they would be allowed to use it for other purposes. It wouldn't have the din of an Oren Kodesh, is what the Ramah is saying. I know there are similar naftamina they talk about. For example, you have in this Aron Kodesh over here, and in many other Aronis Kodesh in different shuls around the world, they have a safe inside the Aron Kodesh. Now you think of it, the Aron itself, the outside of the Aron, for sure is there for the covered of the Sifrei Torah. It's not really there in order to protect them, but the safe is really more in order to protect them. So therefore, that safe might be the same din as what the Ur Zeruah is saying about the niche. And therefore, when the safe itself wears out and they have to replace it, then the safe itself you might be able to throw away or melt down or, sell it as scrap metal or whatever rather than having it have intrinsic kedusha and have to put it in chains.
That's one of two separate pieces.
So we're talking about, in other words, you have a safe inside the own kedusha, right? Yeah. Okay. So the Gemara tells another story involving a shul and an own kedusha. Ha'hu beit knishta di Yehudoi Roimoi. There was a shul of Jews who had come from Rome. So they came from Rome to Mechuzah. Now it's interesting. I mean, Rome and Mechuzah are a couple of thousand miles apart. How do Jews who, we don't just mean Jews from the Roman Empire, the Pashas, we mean from the actual city of Rome. How do they wind up in Mechuzah? You actually find in history books from those times that there were several times when the Romans invaded parts of Babylon. Sometimes they kind of conquered them for greater or lesser amounts of time. So apparently at some time during that time, Jews from Rome, or Mesama, they weren't necessarily part of the Roman army, but they were along with them as assistants or to sell them supplies or whatever it is. And so they went, so enough of them wound up in Mechuzah that they had a shul of their own. Anyway. So they had this shul, to have a pasiach lahu idroina. The shul was opened up into another room to have a machis bay mess. In that room, there was a mess. They had the mess was there. They hadn't yet taken the mess out to bury him. Now, the problem is that the Kohenim wanted to be able to go into the shul. And they can't because the door is open between the two rooms. And the pashas, there wasn't a door. There was just like a hallway or something. And therefore, the Truma is going to come in. But that's the problem. Kohenim wanted to go and daven in the shul. And what can they do as long as the mess is there? Also, Amru le the Rava. So they came and told the Rava, who was the Rav and the Rosh Hashiva in Mechuzah. Amalahu, so he tells them, Dalu Tevusa, pick up the Teva, the Oren, the Oren with the Sifrei Torah, Osvuha, and put it over there, or the Pashtus, it means when the Oren is empty. They didn't always keep the Sifrei Torah in the Oren in the shul. Many times what they would do is, and you even see this sometimes, there are some shuls where they do this nowadays also. They have the Oren in the shul, but then afterwards they would take the Sefer Torah out and put it someplace in somebody's house for safekeeping or whatever. So for Pashas here, it was the same kind of thing. So Rava tells them, take the Oren, and put it in that hallway to block the hallway, to block the doorway or the window or whatever it is. Different Rishonim talk about there may have been just a window between this room and the next room. Now, the good of it is that the Aron Kodesh is a wooden keli that's meant to stay in one place. It's not usually moved around from one place to another. Such a wooden keli is not makabel tuma, and therefore the chotzitz b'fnei tuma. Therefore, it'll block the tuma from the other room from coming into the shul, and now the kohenim will be able to come in. But the chachamim of the yeshiva told Rava that doesn't work because zimnin demitaltulei kimanach sefer Torah ilavei. Sometimes they move the Aron Kodesh when the sefer Torah is on it or in it. V'havalei metaltul amolivirekam, and in that case, then it's a kliyetz which is moved when it's full as well as when it's empty. And the din is when you have a wooden keli that is only moved when it's empty, then it's not makabel tumah, because then the point is like this. For a wooden keli to be makabel tumah, it has to be similar to a sack. Because the pasuk puts in one, and the pasuk mentions back to back. So you have a hekesh between kliyetz and sack. So now, just like a sack, you carry it sometimes empty, sometimes full, the same way. For a wooden keli to be makabel tumah, it has to be that it's moved sometimes empty and sometimes full. So Rava thought that they never moved the Aron Kodesh at all. But they pointed out to him, not only do they move it, but sometimes they move it even with the Sefer Torah inside it. So therefore, v'havalei metaltulei molivirekam. So therefore, it's moved empty, or therefore it's moved sometimes full, sometimes empty.
What's about the Mishnayos we learn in the back of this,
for Shlishutis and Enzim.
If you have a big keli that's considered.
So what about if you have Baba Midah? So the Ritzvah talks about that. He says, there's two things. If the keli is, first of all, he says, so what's the story? If you measure the Aron Kodesh, see whether it holds 40 sa or not. He says there's two different things. There can be a keli that holds 40 saw, where there it's not mekabel truma, like the examples you're mentioning from those mishnayos, from Torah Shetrisanein. Then you have where it's less than 40 saw, but if it always stays in one place and you don't move it, moli v'rekon. So that was the situation. The Aron Kodesh over here is smaller than 40 saw. However, Rava thought that they usually always keep it in one place and they never move it with the Sefer Torah, and they're telling him it's not so. So Rava says, in that case, then you're right, there's no alternative. They're going to have to take out the mess before any Kohenim can come into the shul. By the way, the Poskim learned from this, I think the Ma'aril talks about this, a point you see from this, that if there's a mess in a house, the Kohenim, and then preventing the Kohenim from being able to go in there, the Kohenim don't have the right to say to the guy, you better get your mess out of here, it's interfering with us. When they're going to do the Levaya, they'll take out the mess, but they can't force him to take it out prematurely.
It's not covered a mess.
Right, so it's not covered a mess, so just take him out. Right. More dinim about Tashmish Ekdusha, Omer Mazutra, Mitkochai Svarim Shabalu, the cloth, the manflach or whatever that they wrap Svarim and Sifrei Torah in, if those wear out, Oisin Tachrifim a Mess Mitzvah, then what they should do is they should make them as Tachrifim for a Mess Mitzvah. Vizui Gnizos, and that's how you put them in Gniz. In other words, instead of just burying them in the ground, use them for a mitzvah, which is also binding on the tzibur. These cloths were used by the tzibur to wrap up their Sefer Torah. Now, a mess mitzvah is also chal on the tzibur, therefore use it as tachrichen for him. V'amar Rava, similarly Rava says, Sefer Torah Shabbala, if a Sefer Torah wears out, you can't read from it anymore, goins in oisa, etzal tamat chacham, they put it in Gnizah by burying it next to a Tamar Chacham. And it doesn't have to be a Tamar Chacham, even like a high-level Tamar Chacham, but Afilu Shona Halachas, even if he's only on the level where he learned Mishnayis and Braises, that's enough of a respectful place to put the Sefer Torah. Omer of Achabayakov, all the Kli Cheres. So Achabayakov says, when you're burying it there, though, you should bury it in an earthenware container. Because that way, at least it doesn't start rotting right away. At least that way, the earthenware container will preserve it for some amount of time. So this way, like, it's not right away going to go start rotting. Shanema, as we see in a pasuk, where Hashem tells Yirmiyah to preserve a document for a long time, and he tells him, you should put it in an earthenware container, l'man yam v'yamim rabim, so it'll last for a long time. So the same way over here, you do that, and that way at least it has a chance of lasting a while. You see, for example, the Dead Sea Scrolls were in earthenware containers, and they lasted a couple of thousand years. It is also there. It was a dry climate. It's by the Dead Sea, so it's a little different. But still, you know. Not in the water. They found them in caves. They found them in caves near the Dead Sea. But they were in earthenware containers, and many of them were still in a decent state of preservation even after 1,800 years or so, yeah. For Amra Papi Mishmeder Rav, Mi Bei Knishta Lebei Rabbanon Shori. If you want to take a place that used to be a shul and turn it into Beis Medrash, then that's allowed. Mi Bei Rabbanon, Bei Knishta also, but the other way around, to take a Beis Medrash and turn it into a shul would be also because it's going down a level in Kedusha.
Which one's more holy?
So which one was holier? We're saying the Bei Rabbanon, the yeshiva. The yeshiva has a greater degree of Kedusha. But Rabbanon, Mishmei the Rava, Masni Ikra. Now, on the other hand, so that was Rav Papi said in the name of Rava. Sorry, I said Rav. In the name of Rava had said that it's a lot, that's how it is. Rav Papa learns in the name of Rava the other name. So, which version do we follow? Amar Rav Acha, have a say that a Papi Nistabra. It's more logical to go according to Rav Papi's version, namely that a Beis Medrash has a greater Kedusha than a Shul. And therefore that you can upgrade from a Shul to a Beis Medrash, but not the other way around. To Amar Rav Yeshua ben Levi, because we see that Rav Yeshua ben Levi says, Beis HaKnesses, Mutal Asa, Yisei Beis Medrash. Shmamino, so this, since Rav Yeshua ben Levi said that, we can accept that. Tosfos points out, we're actually going to have a machloikus in a minute between Rav Yechanan and Rav Yeshua ben Levi. The fact that we say that we can follow Rav Yeshua ben Levi shows that that in general, when you have a machloikus between the two of them, the halachas are going to be like Rav Yeshua ben Levi. Bechlal, what you have is Rav Yeshua ben Levi was a generation before Rav Yechanan. I don't know if he was actually one of Rav Yechanan's rebbes, but he was a generation before him. The usual rule is that up until the time of Abaye and Rava, the halacha is usually like the Udir opinion. After the time of Abaye and Rava, since they started compiling shas as we know it, and therefore they had to know everything that everybody before them said, then from then on we usually say halacha kabasroi, the halacha is usually like the later authority. But up until that point, not, and that would be one reason, so Tosfos doesn't mention out of here, but that might be one reason why we're saying the halacha is like the Rishon Levi, because he's the previous generation before Rav Yechanan.
So respecting for for the elders, or could be the later generations more than.
So it's not so much respect for the elders. I mean, there's the idea that the scat and ladurus, that as the generations go by, then the later generations are of lesser caliber. But there's the idea, in other words, that up until the time of Abaye and Rava, let's say, for example, now when Rabbi Yochanan is saying his opinion, not necessarily does he know what Rabbi Shimon Levi said. Maybe we could say if he knew what Rabbi Shimon Levi said, he might have changed his mind. So we would say that the earlier generation, Rabbi Shimon Levi, being that he's closer to Matan Torah and is on a higher level, then we accept his opinion. Only after Abaye and Rava do we say differently. Because then it's their job to know what the later one said, what the earlier one said.
Abaye and Rava was the common point.
Right. Okay. So, Dorash Bakapara, so in this connection, Bakapara said of Dorasha, my dichtiv, what does it mean when it describes the Churban at the end of Sefer Malachim? It says, Muzaradim came to Yerushalayim, by Yisrep as Beis Hashem, that's Beis Hamelech. He burnt the house of Hashem, the Beis Mikdash, and the house of the king, the palace, the Eskol Bote Yerushalayim, and all the houses of Yerushalayim, the Eskol Beis Godol Saraf Be'esh, and all the big houses he burnt in fire. So let's learn those phrase by phrase. So, Beis Hashem is a Beis Mikdash. Beis Hamelech Elu Paltu Yerushalayim means the king's palace. The Eskol Bote Yerushalayim means Kamashmon, means exactly what it sounds like, the houses of the individual citizens of Yerushalayim. Now, what is the ace called base god or sarah fish? What does that mean? If it says they burnt all the houses, then obviously they burnt the big houses as well. So what is that saying? So Rabbi Yechon and Rabbi Shurban Levi. So Rabbi Yechon and Rabbi Shurban Levi argue what those words base god or means. Chad om amokim shem gadlin by Torah. One says, and we're going to show soon that it's that which one is which, that one of them says it's the place where they make tefillah, where they make Torah greater. They learn Torah, but they learn Torah, but Rabin, and in that way they're making the Torah greater. So it means the Bote Medrash. So the Rabin burnt down the Bote Medrash that were in Yerushalayim. The other one says it means a place where they make Tefillah greater, in other words, the shuls. Manda Omer Torah, the one who says that the Pasuk is referring to places of Torah, to Bote Medrash, where do we get that the word Godol is in connection with that? Hashem Chofetz Man Sidkei. Hashem wanted, in order to give the Jewish people lots of tzedakah, in order to give them lots of sposim, Yagil Torah V'Yagil, that he made the Torah great and glorious. So we see that Godol is associated with Torah. Manda Omer Tefillah, the opinion that says that it's places of Tefillah, where do we see that Godol was associated with Tefillah? Dichtiv, because the Pasuk says that at one point, the king of Israel asks Gehazi, Sapra na Hagdolah Sasha Osir Elisha, tell me please of the great things that Elisha accomplished, and how did Elisha accomplish? Ve'Elisha de'Ovad, what Elisha did, Ve'Rachmi hu de'Ovad, he accomplished it by davening to Hashem. So we see that davening is associated with the word Gdolah. Now, the Chassam Sofer says an interesting point. How do we know that Elisha did his nisim by davening to Hashem? Maybe he did it using names of Hashem.
But it's not
the same thing. Davening means you daven to Hashem, please do such and such. Names of Hashem means the person knows names of Hashem that he can use to accomplish nisim, like Sefer Yitzir or whatever. So how do we know he didn't do with that? So one interesting answer is that we find that a person who has hana from other people is not supposed to use names of Hashem. And here, where we know that Elisha did that, because the Gemara, in fact, in Bracha says that a person is allowed, that Elisha, when he traveled from one place to another, he would accept achnasas arachim from people, for example, from the Isha of Shunamis and her husband, so therefore he wouldn't have been able to use names of Hashem like that. So therefore, of necessity, it has to be that he accomplished it through davening. A different other interesting point that they answer is that specifically, one of the nisim that Gehazi was telling the king about over there is that story where Elisha revived the son of the Isha Shunamis, and the Pasuk actually says there that he davened to Hashem by Yispalel Hashem. It's an Aftorah, Parshas Vayera, so therefore it's clear that he did that through Tefillah. Another very interesting answer actually is that if he had done it using names of Hashem, then the child wouldn't have been able to speak ever afterwards. Then it would have been like, for example, when the Maharal created the Golem, or for example, you find in Sanhedrin, where Rava created a Golem using Sefer Yetzirah, where they're not able to speak. Right. Yeah, the Gemara mentions that Rava did. So only Hashem has the ability to give a person to speak. Therefore, if the child is able to speak afterwards, it means that he must have revived him using davening to Hashem. Yeah. Anyway, okay. Now, which one said which? We said Rabbi Yechon and Rabbi Shurban Levi have their respective opinions, but which one said which? Tistayim did Rabbi Shurban Levi, who drew Amma Mokum Shemagadlin by Torah. We can conclude we can demonstrate that Rabbi Shimon Levi is the one who says that Beis Gadol means the Beis Medrash, the place where they great, where they make the Torah greater. The Amr Rabbi Shimon Levi, Beis Haknesses, Mutalasa is the Beis Medrash. We just said that he says they were allowed to turn a shul into a Beis Medrash, showing that he holds that Beis Medrash is greater than a shul. Therefore, the word Beis Gadol is more appropriate for it. Shema Mina, so that proves that that's what it is. He's the one who explains it. He's the one who explains it that way. Rabbi Yechanan understands that it means the shuls.
Question. Couldn't we derive that from the fact that the Torah says Limud HaTorah Keneged Kulam? So by definition, that should prove that a Beis Midrash is greater than a shul.
Well, okay, but on the other hand, we see that Rabbi Yochanan disagrees, and we see that
Rabbi How can he disagree?
Talmud Torah may be Keneged Kulam. That doesn't mean that a place of Talmud Torah is necessarily greater than a place where you daven.
Of course it does.
No, it doesn't. There's two different things. There's the greatness of learning Torah, and then there's the greatness of the place where you learn Torah. You could still say, as great as learning Torah is, maybe a shul is more important. And that's what Rabbi Yechanan is saying, and that's what Rabbi Papa is saying. So it's a valid point, but nevertheless, we're still saying that we follow Rabbi Shimon Levi.
They didn't bring any solid reason.
The reason was because he doesn't need a reason. He said he learns the pasuk that's called Beis Gadol Sarach Ba'esh, and he's saying since it says Yag Yotzer of Yadir, then it means therefore that the Beis Medrash exceeds the kedusha of a shul. That's what it is. That's how Rabbi Shimon Levi learned, and that's what we're saying.
Yeah.
All right, let's go on. We said Abba Machr Torah LaYikus Sfarim. We said if the tzibur sold a sefer Torah, then they're not allowed to use the money to buy other Sfarim. So we have a question. Are they allowed to sell an older Sifrei Torah in order to use the money to buy a new one? Do we say, on the one hand, they're not going up in Kedusha, so maybe it's also, maybe the Mishnah is implying that you always have to go up in Kedusha, and since there's nothing higher than a Sifrei Torah, then you can't. Or maybe that's just it. Since there's no higher that you can go, there's nothing that has higher kedusha than a sefer Torah, shakur dummy, maybe it would be fine. In other words, you could say the rest of the Mishnah, for example, where it says that if they sold Sfarim, they shouldn't be buying with it a teva, let's say, fine, because the alternative is don't buy a teva, buy a sefer Torah, go up in level. But here, with a sefer Torah, you have no other alternative, so maybe you're allowed to go on the same level. So Tashma, let's try to bring a proof. The Mishnah had said, Abba Machru Torah LaYikus Sfarim. The Mishnah says if they sell a Sefer Torah, they're not allowed to use the money to buy Sfarim, implying Sfarim hu deloy, so implying they're not allowed to use it to buy Sfarim ha-Torah v'Torah shapur dami, implying but they can use the money to buy another Sefer Torah. So that would show that you could. The answer is the Gemara says that's not a proof. Masnissim Dieved. The Mishnah is talking about Dieved. They sold the Sefer Torah. What are they allowed and not allowed to do with the money? Our question is, are they lachatzchila allowed to sell their old Sefer Torah in order to buy a new one? You can't see that one way or the other from the Mishnah. Tashma, let's try to bring another proof. A braisa says, Gerlin Sefer Torah b'mitpachas chumashin. You're allowed to roll up a Sefer Torah in the mitpachas, in the mantle that's usually used for chumashin. So you have, in other words, a mantle that previously was used for a chumash. You're allowed now to use it for a Sefer Torah. B'chumashin b'mitpachas nevi'im uksuvim. You're allowed to wrap up chumashin using the mantle that you used for nevi'im uksuvim and nevi'im uksuvim. But not the other way around. You can't wrap up Nevi'im and Ksuvim in wrappings of Chumashim, because Chumashim are on a higher level. And you can't wrap up a Chumash in the mantle of a Sefer Torah. Katani Mias, now, the bottom line is, the Braised said, Gerlin Sefer Torah Mepachas Chumashim. The Braised said you can wrap up a Sefer Torah in Mepachas, in cloth that were used to previously wrap Chumashim, implying Mepachas Chumashim Ein, Mepachas Sefer Torah Loi, implying that you can't wrap up one Sefer Torah in the mantle of a different one. So it sounds like, in other words, you can't even use a mantle from one Sefer Torah for another Sefer Torah, so how could you be able to sell one Sefer Torah in order to buy another? One second, you're wondering to yourself, what do you mean? We trade mantle among Sefer Torahs all the time. Hold on. Ema Sefer, the Gemara says, on the other hand, look at the next part of the Braisa. It said, V'loi chumashim v'mitpachas Sefer Torah. It said, you can't wrap up chumashim in cloths that are used to wrap up the Sefer Torah, because you're going down in Kedusha. Ha Torah v'Torah shapur dami, implying that you could wrap up one Sefer Torah in another Sefer Torah's mantle. So Adarabba, that would show that you could. And in that case, you could also sell one Sefer Torah to buy another. The Gemara says, okay, Elamah Holak Elamishma Minah, you can't prove anything from this braisa. There's obviously something inexact in this braisa. There's something which is not being medayik, and we don't know what it is. So Lamai says, as far as wrapping one sefer Torah and a mantle of another, we don't have a problem with it. But we still haven't answered the question yet about selling one sefer Torah to buy another. So wait. So Toshma, the Gemara says, let's try to bring another proof. Manichin sefer Torah al gabi Torah. You're allowed to put one sefer Torah on top of another one. The Torah al gabi chumashin. You're also allowed to put a sefer Torah on top of chumashin. The chumashin al gabi neviim uksuvim. You're allowed to put chumashin on top of neviim and uksuvim. But not the other way around. Neviim uksuvim on top of chumashim. And you can't put a chumash on top of a sefer Torah. So the fact that you can put one sefer Torah on top of another means, by the same token, we should assume that you're allowed to sell one sefer Torah in order to buy another. The Gemara says, Hanocha kamir. You're trying to bring a proof from putting Sfarim down. Shiny Hanocha, delayesh. Listen, when it comes to putting them down, you could say the reason you're allowed to is because there's no alternative. Where else? Sometimes you have to put it one sefer Torah on top of another. After all, if you weren't going to say it like that, you would have to ask yourself, never mind putting one sefer Torah on top of another. Michra hechi karchinan. How are you ever allowed to roll up a sefer Torah? Right? Don't you have one page, one column of the sefer Torah is lying on top of another one? So obviously, obviously the answer is there's no alternative, so therefore it's allowed. The same way you could say, when you're putting one sefer Torah on top of another, you're talking about where you don't have any room, and therefore you have to necessarily put one on top of the other. That doesn't show no proof that, because of that, that you would be allowed to sell one sefer Torah to buy another. By the way, as far as this matter of putting Torah on top of another, so this is where we get the halachas that we have. Now, the Aruch HaShulchan says, actually, that all of this discussion is only talking about handwritten Sfarim. He says printed Sfarim don't have that same degree of Kedusha, and he says you would, in fact, be allowed to put any printed Sefer on top of any other. So even, for example, let's say a Siddur on top of a Chumash. On the other hand, most of the other posts can disagree with the Aruch HaShulchan on that, and that's why we have the hierarchy that we're familiar with, that you can put most Sfarim on top of each other. You put Nevi'im and Ksuvim are considered on an equal level for that purpose, and you can put any one of them on top of any other, and Chumashim go on top. And you don't put anything else on top of the Chumash except, as we're saying, a sefer Torah.
How about the Siddur?
The fact that the poskim do say, when they're all bound together in one volume, then it's different. For example, the Gemara tells us in Baba Basra that you're allowed to have one huge scroll of Torah and Nevi'im and Ksuvim. So some of the Mefarshim say there could conceivably be a problem with that. And therefore, they say what you would have to do is you would have to keep that scroll as much as possible rolled to the end. That way, the Sefer Torah part is on the outside of the Nevi'im and Ksuvim part. But most of the other Mefarshim say that there's no problem with that, because that's the derech. When you have one scroll, then you're going to have some parts on top of another, so it's not a problem. So that answers the question, for example, about a Siddur that has Tillim in the back, for example. So there's no problem of the pages of a Siddur being on top of the Tillim. By the same token, also, they talk about, are you allowed to print a one-volume Tanakh? On the face of it, fine, you have the Torah at the beginning, but when you're opening the Sefer and you're using it, at times you're going to have pages of Nevi'im and Ksuvim are going to be on top of Chumash. Again, most of the posts can say that's not a big deal, because that's the normal way of using it, and in a certain sense, you could even say that in that case, the Nevi'im and Ksuvim are serving as like a shomer, like a guard, like they're helping protect the pages of the Torah. But when you have one separate volumes, then not, then you can't put anything on top of the Chumash. There is also something that the Chassidim have a minhag not to put anything on top of a Tanya, because Tanya, after all, is Torah Shel Chassad of Torah Chassidus. So even a Chumash, I guess, yeah, I don't know. I forgot to mention, by the way, before, when we were talking about boxes and things for Sfarim, the Poskim do point out that, for example, bookshelves are not necessarily, we talked about things that are used to protect the Sfarim rather than as honor to them. Bookshelves are in that category, the fact that most of the Sfarim on the bookshelves are bound in their own covers, so therefore, like in a certain sense, the bookshelf is only attachment to Kusha, and therefore it doesn't have the same degree of Kusha. When a bookshelf that you can't use for Sfarim anymore wears out, you're allowed to use it for other things. There is also a point, actually, that many times we say there's a certain implicit tnai. When you put up a bookshelf, there's a certain tnai involved that you can put other things on it as well. And therefore, that also makes it mutter to put other things on it and to use it for other purposes when you don't need it for Sfarim anymore.
For example, so now you're going to throw it out. You can't keep it forever.
Right, that's okay. Yeah. Okay. So anyway, so we're still in the discussion. So Toshma, the Amar Rav Bavachana, Amar Rav Yechon, Meshum Rav Shimon Gamliel, we say Rav Bavachana says, Lo Yivka Adam Sefer Torah Yashem Lekach Bechadosh. You're not allowed to sell an old Sefer Torah in order to buy a new one. So there's our answer. The Gemara says, that's not a proof. Hosim Meshum Pshiosa. Because there, we're talking about there where you don't have the new Sefer Torah yet, so you may get terrorists. They sold the other Sefer Torah. The new Sefer Torah is not ready yet. Meanwhile, they may spend the money on something else, and then they don't have a Torah at all. So that's not a proof. That case, sure. Kikam Yunin, what we're asking about, the other Sefer Torah is already written. It's all ready to be bought from the Sefer. All you need is the money. So now you want to know, can you sell an old Sefer Torah in order to raise money for the new one? My. So what's the din? Tashma, let's try to bring another proof. To Amar Rav Yechon Meshum Rav Meir, Ein Moshrin Sefer Torah Ela Lumad Torah V'Lisaisha. You're not allowed to sell a Sefer Torah only in order to use the money to learn Torah. Now that can mean in order to support yourself while you're learning Torah. Rashi says it can also mean, I think the Rambam says that it means to pay Schar Limud for learning Torah, or V'Lisaisha, or in order to have money to get married. So, Shmamina Torah v'Torah Shapir Dami. So you see from that, you're allowed to sell one Sefer Torah to buy another one, because what are you getting the new one for? You're b'pashtus in order to learn, and in order to learn from it. The answer is not necessarily. Do a shiny limud, shall limud maybe the day ma'isa. Maybe it's different when you're selling the Sefer Torah in order to be able to learn Torah, because, as we know, Talmud Torah is a tremendous thing, because it leads to ma'isa. So therefore, you could say that that's different. That is Sefer Torah, which they're just using for laning and shul, which is not really learning Torah to the same degree. Isha Nami, and we could say the reason also, by the way, I have a Moshe, this might answer your question also, we were saying before, that Talmud Torah connected Kulan. Fine, but on the other hand, we say that Talmud may be the day Maisa. So in that case, maybe the Maisa, including davening, in a certain sense, could be considered great. Anyway, Isha Nami, when it comes to getting married, also we can say that's a very important reason, because after all, the Pasuk says Hashem didn't create the world for nothingness. He made it in order to be settled. So therefore, getting married is a very important mitzvah. It's the purpose for which the Eibishter put us in the world in the first place. So therefore, you could say that, yeah, Abel Torah v'Torah Loi. But not necessarily, maybe still you can't sell one Sefer Torah in order to buy another one. So still no proof yet. So the Gemara says, Tanarabanan, the Gemara says, we learn in a Braisa, Lo Yimko Adam Sefer Torah Af Bishen Tzarif Loi. A person should not sell a Sefer Torah even though he doesn't need it, because let's say Rashi says he has another one. Yetra Kain Omer of Shimon Gamliel. The Shimon Gamliel says, beyond that, Afilo Ein Loi Ma Yosel, even if a person doesn't have what to eat, he doesn't have money, he doesn't have food, Umachar Sefer Torah, and he sells a Sefer Torah in order to have money for food, or he sells his daughter as an Omer Hevriya, where we know the Torah tells us in Parshas Mishpatim that he could, but still, he will never see a Simen Bracha from that money. Now, the Gemara has not really answered the question, though. Lamaisa, can you sell an old Sefer Torah to buy a new one? So here you actually have a machlokes between the Shach and the Taz about it. The Shach says, since the Gemara has not concluded it, we have to be machmir with a suffix. Fine, it's a suffix de Rabbanan, but still, it's a suffix involving the covered of the Torah, and therefore you have to be machmir. On the other hand, the Taz says, maybe not. Rav Moshe has in one of his Chuvas, he says we should be machmir like the Shach. On the other hand, there are some exceptions to that. First of all, Tosfos in Bava Basra, which is referenced here on the side, says that also they could sell a Sefer Torah for Pidyon Shvuyim. Because Tosfos says, the Gemara didn't mention over here, because it's obvious. If he's saying that you can sell a Sefer Torah in order to learn Torah, or in order to get married, how much more so Pidyon Shvuyim, which is a greater mitzvah than everything, than almost anything else. On the other hand, the Rambam seems to disagree with that, and Hagoris Maimonius asks on the Rambam how he could disagree. So for Pidyon Shvuyim is not necessarily so simple. There you have a machlokas on that. Where the old Sefer Torah was possible, then Rav Moshe writes in one of his Trovas that you are allowed to sell it in order to buy a new one, because anyway, you can't use it for laning.
You can fix it then, does not.
If you can fix it, fine. Sometimes you have a possible Sefer Torah which can't be fixed. Think of, for example, here's an example. You know that Sefer Torah that they wrote, that Hatzalah sponsored a couple of years ago at the beginning of Corona, the Sefer Torah for protection. So then you have a few months ago during the hurricane where places were flooded all over the place, and one of those Sefer Torah, unfortunately, was badly damaged by water. So it wasn't fixable anymore. So now that that they can't sell anymore, fine. I mean, there's nobody's gonna buy it. But let's say, for example, it was damaged enough that you can't, it's not really possible to fix it. On the other hand, So
changing the whole, I guess the whole thing was wet.
So the whole thing was wet. So yeah, they would have had to rewrite the whole thing.
Like, what is someone to get to have
that's how I'm thinking.
So in general, we say that you shouldn't. On the other hand, again, there are details about it. When it's a sefer Torah that belongs to an individual, then the poskim are a little more makel on it. Even though we're saying over here in the Gemara, ain't a roya sim bracha lo'olam, fine, but you are allowed to, they say, especially because when a poskim himself has a sefer Torah, it's almost like there's an implicit t'nai in it, maybe, like we were talking before about t'noyim, that he could sell it if need be. Definitely, they say that if, for example, a person, let's say, received a sefer Torah in payment of a debt or something, then for sure he's allowed to resell it because he didn't himself buy it at all. So there are different details about these things that have to be checked with a rav. If you're in that situation where you want to sell a sefer Torah, then you check with a rav about the details.
I thought they had a sharper and a nicer, newer, a better lamp, a long lasting sefer Torah.
So right. According to the Taz, it would be fine. According to the Shah, not necessarily. Yeah.
Now, the English in the Lacha, I think it was only if you sell your daughter for a moment.
No, we said both. Lacha Sefer Torah, or Yibita. We're saying both. Yeah. Okay. We said in the Mishnah, V'chein b'moisrei, and we said the same dinim applied to the leftovers, meaning, in other words, we said they sold Sfarim, and they used the money to buy a Sefer Torah. And now they have some of the money left over. They also can't use that to downgrade in Kedusha. They have to go start putting that money for a higher level of Kedusha. So the Gemara says, Omar Rabba, Lo Shanu Elisha Machru Vahisiru. That's only talking about when they had an item of Kedusha, which they sold, and now they have money left over because they didn't need all the money for the new thing. Abu Gavu Vahisiru. But if to begin with, they collected money for the Tzibra, let's say, for example, to buy a Sefer Torah, and Vahisiru, and there's money left over that they didn't need towards the Sefer Torah, Mutter, then they're allowed to use it for a lower level of Kedusha, because after all, it wasn't yet used for a higher level of Kedusha. It was only collected for that purpose. Eis Fabaya. Fabaya says, what do you mean? Abraisa says, Bamed Varamumim Shalai Hisnu. When is this talking about the dinim of our Mishnah that you can only go up in Kedusha, not down? Only if they didn't make a Tanai. Abel Hisnu. But the Braisa says, if they did make a Tanai, that we want to be able to use the leftover money for something else, afilu the duchsusia mutter, then you're allowed to use that leftover money even for duchsusia, which we'll explain soon in the Gemara what that means. So Abaya says, hey, chidami. Now you have to think, what's the scenario that the Braisa is talking about? Are we talking about, let's say, where they already had Svarim and sold them, and now we said they used most of the money for a Sefer Torah, and now they have leftover? What would it help if they made up Tanai? The Mishnah said they have to go up in Kedusha. The fact is, you had an item that had Kedusha, you transferred the Kedusha onto the money, how can you now go and use the money for something else, even with a Tanai? Evidently, we have to be talking about where they collected money and there's leftover money afterwards. Time of the Hisnu, and so the Braisa is implying only because they made a Tanai is it Mutter, Holo Hisnu Loi, and implying that if they didn't make a Tanai, then not. So what are you telling me, Rava, that even without a Tanai, you're allowed to use leftover collected money for whatever you want? The answer is Loi, Lo Olam Shamachru Vahisiru. No, because the Braisa could actually be talking about the case where they sold the Sfarim or whatever it is and have money left over. Vahachikamar, so the Braisa means, when we talk about Tanai, means, Bamed Varamum, Shaloi Hisnu Shiva Tuvea Ir, Bemaimat Anshe Ir. We're talking about when the Shiva Tuvea Ir that we talked about previously in the Gemara, the seven people who are responsible for affairs of the Tzibur. They're the ones, they're like the community representatives, so they act on behalf of the Tzibur. So if they didn't make a Tanai, the Maimed, Anshe'ir, in the presence of the people of the city, then you can't use the leftover money for anything you want. Avol, Hisna, Shuvit, Shiva, Tuvayir, Maimed, Anshe'ir, but if they made such a Tanai, when they sold the Sfarim or the Tevar or what have you, then Afilu L'Duchsusya Nami Motor, then it would be allowed to use it even for Duchsusya. In other words, just like we said before, that for example, when they sell the shul, we said that if they sell it shiva tuvei ir b'maimed anshe ir, then we said they're allowed to even use the money to buy beer, to go and make and drink beer. So the same way, because now the whole tzibur agreed to it, we talk about a machloikus of the Ramban and the Ran, what the mechanism is, how that works, but in any case, it does work. So the same way, the price over here could be talking about that. Not necessarily is it talking anything about where they collected money and have left over. There you could say you don't even need it tonight, like Rava says. So now, what is Duchsus? Yeah? So Abaye says to one of the Chachamim who used to arrange Braises in front of Rav Sheches. So in those times, they didn't have Mishnayos and Braises were written down yet. Okay, maybe the Mishnah was written, but the Braises certainly weren't. So you had people whose job was to repeat Braises in the Batei Medrash, and then they would discuss them. So he used to do that. So Abaye asked him, Mish mi aloch mi Rav Sheches mai duchsusya. Have you heard anything from Rav Sheches about what duchsusya is? Amalei, so he tells him, Hochi amar Rav Sheches, parsha de Mosa. It means the horsemen of the city. Which means, Rashi says, let's say, for example, the people of the city sometimes need something from the mayor or the nobleman or whatever who owns the city. So he doesn't necessarily live in the city itself. He lives out of town. So they need to hire somebody to ride on a horse to go tell him what they need in the city. So that's called Parasha Namasa, and that's what's called the Braisa Duchsusya. So we're saying that if they made such a tnai, then they were allowed to use the money even for that. A different explanation of Parasha Demasa is that it means a horseman who rides around the city to guard it. Like they have mounted guards around the city to protect it.
You can even sell it in order to pay him or hire him.
To pay him or hire him, that's what we're saying, yeah.
So Parasha Demasa and Dususus is
the same thing. So Dususus, I guess, is a Greek or Latin or something word for it. And Parasha Demasa is what they called it in Aramaic. It could be. I mean, Duch means a place. You find in some places where the word duch in the Gemara, where duch means a place, sus, yeah, it's like sus, a horse. So maybe it means like a place, like a person whose job it is to ride on the horse. I don't know. Amar Abaye says, Yuluna, a hurrah from this story. If a young Talmid Chacham hears something while he's learning, he doesn't know what it means. Like in this case, we didn't know what the word duch susya means. What he should do is ask, even he can ask somebody who regularly is in front of the Chacham. It's impossible that he won't at some point have heard it from a great person. In other words, this Hahu Min Abonan, Dahu Masadim Masnisa, is not necessarily a great Talmid Chacham, but he was always in Rav Sheshes' Beis Medrash, and therefore he was able to hear the explanation of this, even though he himself is not much of a Talmid Chacham. So the same way that Abaye says, you learn from this, Ahura for life, that make sure to ask these things by people who are regular in this Medrash, they're likely to pick up such things just by overhearing it.
Right.
But the point is, in other words, especially just even though they're not sitting and learning it in the Beis Medrash, they just they overhear it. That itself is a great thing. Okay. Another din in this connection, Amr Abirchen Meshum Rabeir, B'nei Ha'ir Shahochol Ir Acheres. Maybe we're bringing this in because before we brought something from Rav Yechon and then Emre Meir, and now also we are, but more likely it's because that actual topic that we're going to talk about itself has to do with the money that from one city, what we do with it in that city versus another city. That as far as it's done. B'nei ha'ir shahochol ir acheres, if people from one city went to a different city, or poskualein tzedakah, and the Gaboi Tzedakah in that other city told them to give a certain amount of Tzedakah, Noisnin, so they give it there to the Gaboi Tzedakah. They don't say, because you don't want to be choshed them, that they said that they pledged that they're going to give a certain amount and they're not giving it. So they give it there in that city to the Gaboi Tzedakah. Uchshein Boyin, when they come back to their town, Mevi and Oseiman, they can take that money back from the Gaboi Tzedakah and take it with them, or Mefarnes and Ba'anir Iran, and they can use it to support the poor people in their own city.
30 days.
Yeah. So if they were in the other town for less than 30 days, yeah. Tani Nami Hochi, Bnei Ir Shahul Achers, or Postwalin Tzedakah, Noistin, or Shein Boyin, Mevi and Oseiman. On the other hand, the Braisa continues, that's only when you have a bunch of people. On the other hand, if it was one individual person, or less than 10 people, the post can say, who went to a different city, or poskwal of tzedakah, and they got from him a pledge for tzedakah over there, then it does have to be given to the people of that, to the poor people of that city, because it's one thing when you have 10 or more people, you can say they're considered like a miniature city in itself, and therefore like they have the right to take that money and use it for the poor people of their city. But one individual person or a few individual people, they don't have that right. They're bottled to the people of the other city, and therefore the tzedakah that they pledged goes to the people of that city. So the Gemara gives an example. Rav Huna Gozer Tanisa. Rav Huna at one time declared a fast day, whether it was because it didn't have rain or some other sara, as we learned about in Masechta Tainis. Rav Chana bar Chaniloi and other people from his town came to Rav Huna's city. Rav Huna lived in Surah, so they came from some other city to Surah on the day of the Tainis. Romu alai tzedakah, so they demanded from them tzedakah. They got from them pledges for tzedakah. The Yahavu, so they gave it to the Gaboi tzedakah, like we said. Ki bo lemei. Say now when Rav Chana bar Chaniloi and the rest of the Chachamim are getting ready to leave. Omrulay, they said to Rav Huna, Nois Falon Mar, Rebbe, please give us back that money, the nasal and a fire spa near Mosin, and we're gonna go use it for the poor people of our city. Like we just said, they could do that, because they're more than 10 people. Omrulahu, but Rav Huna says this is a different case. Tanena, we said before, we learned in a braisa, but Medron Amurim, She'en Shom Chever Ir. Only if that city where they pledged the tzedakah does not have a Chever Ir. Rashi says that Chever Ir means the rov of the city. A Talmid Chacham ha-mis'asik b'tzarchei tzibur. A Talmid Chacham who's occupying himself with the affairs of the community, and like he's responsible for everything that goes on in the city. There's a different other explanation that some of the Shonim have, that Chever Ir means like a group of gaboi tzedakah, as opposed to like you have, like you can have a case where everybody gives their tzedakah on their own, versus where you have where you have like Kol Chabad or something, where they have like a central foundation for tzedakah where people give through that. Avo Yeshem Chever Ir, but the Braisa continues, if there is a Chever Ir, Tinosim Chever Ir, then it has to be given to the Chever Ir, because he is responsible for everything in the city, he or that group of Gaboi Tzedakah or whatever, is responsible for everything that's in the city, and therefore, in other words, when you pledge the Tzedakah, you pledged it al das that he can do with it what he sees fit. So therefore, you don't have the right to take it back to your city and use it for your own equity. And Rav Huna tells them, how much more so in this case, where the Aniyim here in Surah, as well as in the other town that you came from, are all depending on me, because Surah was the big city in the area, and all the Aniyim, even in the smaller villages nearby, all depended on him. So therefore, Rav Huna says, in that case, you don't have the right to take it and give it at your own discretion to the Aniyim of your place. You leave it over here with me, and it'll end up benefiting them as well. But especially because I'm the Chever here. Okay. Mishnah says,
that's something he just created.
He quoted a braisa.
He quoted a braisa, but they didn't know the braisa when they accepted.
So it happens all the time. That the Gemara brings in braisas that not all the Amoroyim are expected to know all the braisas. The Amoroyim have to know all the Mishnayos. They don't necessarily know all the braises, which is why we just said that you had people whose job was Masader Masnisa to arrange the braises in the Bate Medrash. Yeah. So they didn't know it, but obviously they know that Rav Huna is not just making up a braise, and he's not just making up a braise, he's calling them a braise. In fact, the expression he uses, it's interesting, the expression he used was Tanei Na, we have learned a braise, which means it may even mean it's something he tells them, you should have been expected to know this braise. But whatever the case, whether they did or they didn't, the point is they knew it now.
Less.
Doesn't matter apparently whether they were there 30 days or less, apparently. Yeah.
Those days it wasn't with Melech, no.
Okay. The Mishnah says, Ein Moshkenes Sharabim LeYochim. When you have a shul, that or any of the other things that we said in the previous Mishnah, the Teva, the Sfarim, etc., you're not allowed to sell one that belonged to the Rabbim to a Yochid, to an individual. Because you're taking it down from its degree of Kedusha. It was used by the Rabbim, and now it's only used only by a Yochid. Divrei Rav Meir, that's what Rav Meir says, or Rav Yehuda says on the side. Omru Loi, the Chacham told him, in Cain, if you're going to learn like that, Afloim, Yudol, Yukana, then you wouldn't be allowed to sell it, for example, from a big city to a small city either, because you have fewer people using it now, and obviously you don't save that. So therefore, there's no problem selling it to a Yochid. So the Gemara says, Shapir, Kamri, Lerabon, Rav Meir, Nu, don't the Chachamim have a valid point? Why does Rav Meir distinguish between a Rabbim and Yochid versus a larger Rabbim and a smaller Rabbim? So Rav Meir would answer to that, Me'ir Gdol Le'Uktana, because when you're going from a big city to a small city, fine, Me'ikra Kadisha Hashinami Kadisha. Fine, you still have the same degree of Kedusha, you're still saying Gavash of Kedusha, you're still saying things that are minion over there. Me'Rabim Le'Yochid like a Kedusha. But when you go from Rabim to Yochid, you're not going to be saying Dvorim Shem Kedusha over there anymore. V'Rabbanan, what did the Rabbanan answer to that? They answer, E'ikla Me'chash, if you're going to be concerned about it, kihai gavna nami ikalamechash, then you should be concerned about that also, between many and fewer. Because after all, mishum beroigam hadras melech, the more people in davening, the more people giving honor to Hashem together, the greater it is. And yet it doesn't matter. The fact is, dvorim shebekdusha are dvorim shebekdusha. So therefore, it doesn't really matter, even when you're selling to a yochid, so it doesn't matter. You're allowed to use it. The next Mishnah is going to say there are certain purposes that you're not allowed to use the shul building for, but anything else, as long as he's still using it as a place of kedusha, then it doesn't matter. Then it doesn't matter, even though now there's not necessarily going to be a regular Mishnah there. Let's think.
So he's selling his farm that belongs to the Beis Medrash, he's selling to a private person.
So he's selling to a private person.
It's
saying that's fine.
Still be learned, but
it's still going to be learned. It's going to be learned by fewer people. Right, that's what we're saying.
That's okay.
Yeah. That's what the Mishnah continues. Ein mokrin beis haknesses el al tnai. Now you're only allowed to sell a shul with a tnai shem yutsu yachziruhu, that if the tzibur wants it, they're going to be able to get it back. Divrei Rav Meir. That's what Rav Meir says. So even when you're selling from rabbin to rabbin, Rav Meir says to be zoyan to sell it permanently, like as if we don't need it, as if like we don't care for it. Now we learned on Chavav on the Beis that you had a case over there. We said that that you're not allowed to lend out a shul. You're not allowed to mortgage a shul. So Tosfos had said over there that Rav Meir, that again, you have the difference between Rabim to Rabim. When we say you're not allowed to mortgage it or rent it, it means to a Yachid. So Rav Meir says you're not even allowed to sell it to a Yachid. So then you're also not allowed to rent it or mortgage it to a Yachid. But to Rabim would be fine, he said. Okay. So Divrei Rav Meir, that's what Rav Meir says. You have to sell a shul only out tonight. The Chum say you can sell a shul permanently, and even to a yochid, like they said in the previous Mishnah, with the exception of you're not allowed to sell where the building is going to be used for any of the following four things. L'merchatz, where it's going to be used as a bathhouse, or a burski, or as a tannery, which smells really bad, l'tvila, or a place where they're going to table, or a beis hamayim, or for a beis hamayim. Which means, it actually says two possibilities. A laundry, one is that it means a laundry, a second is that it means a place where they're going to urinate. So those,
urinate?
To urinate, to fish, yeah.
But the tefillah was, it should be a whole thing, the mikvah.
No, so, but nevertheless, still people get undressed in there. So now, it is true, actually, when you have, for example, so I think Moshe talks about in one of his shuvahs, that fine, for example, where you have no alternative, you need a mikveh for the women, and the halacha is that even you're allowed to sell a shul in order to build a mikveh for the women, that's a valid reason to, in fact, building a mikveh takes precedence, so then maybe we would say that yes, then maybe you could sell it, then maybe you could sell it for that, but not otherwise. If you have an alternative, then you should.
Yeah, so for a church.
For a church, it is even more bizarre, yeah, so. Rabbi Yehuda, I'm a merchant, I sell a shem chotzer. Rabbi Yehuda says what you can do is you can sell the place as a chotzer. But mashi yotze yasa, and then the buyer can do whatever he wants with it. Because then, in other words, the kedusha is completely taken off from it, and you can do whatever you want with it. Definitely, though, the post can say that if, for example, the person who buys it is going to be tearing down the building and building a new one, then for sure you're allowed to use that place for whatever is necessary. So the Gemara asks, now, according to Rav Meir, that you're making a tnai, so in other words, at any time, you can undo the sale and refund the money. The problem is, meanwhile, how is the guy who bought it allowed to live there? How have you le ribis? Don't you have a problem of ribis? You paid, for example, $1 million for this building. You're living in it now. Eventually, when they undo the sale, you're going to be returning them their $1 million. Meanwhile, you've been living in there for free. So in effect, you're getting a benefit for the fact that you lent them money.
The tzibur got the benefit, right?
They got the $1 million. Meanwhile, though, the guy who bought it is living over there. So don't you have a problem of ribis? The answer is, Amar Rav Yechonon, Rav Meir b'shittas Rav Yehuda. Rav Meir, in this particular detail, is following the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda, the Omer Sad Echa Beribis Mutter, who says when you have one-sided ribis, then it's mutter. Now, one-sided ribis means, in other words, it's not necessarily going to be ribis, because they might end up buying back the place. They might not. Now, Tosfos points out, you do have cases in Bava Metzia, in Ezer Neshech, which is the whole parak that talks about the details of ribis. You have many cases over there where you have only one possibility, and we say it is considered ribis, at least in Abba. The difference is, Tosfos says, that over here there wasn't even a loan in the first place. When you have something similar to a loan, like when you have a loan or something similar to a loan, and you have tzad echad, then you have a problem. But here, there's no loan at all. It's done as a sale. Implicitly, it's going to end up being a loan if it turns out that they buy back the place and it turns out that the guy had, in effect, only borrowed it for a period of time. Since it wasn't done as a loan in the first place, and it's only tzad echad, then Rabbi Yehuda says it's mutter.
And this Libby's question is on the rab, is on the shul, on the rabbi?
Is on the person who's living there. That we sold him the building. So he sold him the building. Now he's living there. Eventually, if he gives back the place and they give him back the money, then it comes out in effect that the money was only a loan for a period of time, and meanwhile he was living there for free.
He was living free, but he took care of the maintenance of the place.
There wasn't necessarily any maintenance there. The answer is, since there wasn't an actual loan in the first place, it was structured as a sale, and it's only tzad echad, it's not necessarily that there's going to be rivis involved, Rabbi Yehuda says it's mutter, Rabbi Meir is following that sheet. D'tanya, as in fact we learn in a braisa, Harei shehoya noshe b'chaverin moneh, suppose that a person is owed a money by somebody else, the Ruvain previously lent Shimon a money, 100 zuz, and also by Sedeu Mecher. So Shimon says to Ruvain, I'm making my field is going to be a potential sale to you, meaning I'm mortgaging my field to the loan that if I don't pay back the loan by such and such a date, then you get this field. So if the seller continues to eat the payrus of the field during the life of the loan, then it's mutter, because then there's no ribis at all. Because then obviously, the moicher continues to eat the payrus. He's not giving anything extra to the lekeach. Lekeach eichel payrus also. But if the buyer eats the payrus, then it's also. Because now, if he does end up paying back the loan, then it comes out that the lekeach got something extra. He gets back his money as well as he has the food that he ate for free. Rabbi Yehuda, I'm after the lekeach eichel payrus mutter. On the other hand, Rabbi Yehuda says it's mutter even if the lekeach is eating payrus. And the Omer of Yehuda, and Rabbi Yehuda says, I'll bring you a proof. It happened with Baisus ben Zunan, who was a balabas in the time, he was a rich balabas in the times of Tanoim. We find in various places in Shas, it mentions things that he did. So he wasn't one of the Chachamim, but he was closely associated with the Chachamim. And we often find the Gemara often brings proofs from what he did, because whenever he did something, he always made sure to ask a Shaila and follow what the Chachamim said. So Sha'asa Sadeo Mecher, Alpira Velozim and Azalia, he did that. He arranged for a Mecher of his field, according to Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. In other words, he asked Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah to tell him what to do in this, that there shouldn't be a problem with ribis. But Lekeach Echol Peiris on you. And the Lekeach was eating the Peiris. So you see, there's no problem.
So he sold the field.
So in other words, so let's say, for example, Baisus had borrowed money from somebody else. He tells somebody else, if I don't pay you back by such and such a time, then this field of mine, you'll be able to keep it. Now, during the time, during the life of the loan, the lekeach, Rabbi Yehuda is saying, was eating the payers. The other guy, not Baisus, but the other guy, was eating the payers. And there's obviously no problem. So you see that it's allowed. Yuloy, the Chachamim said to Rabbi Yehuda, Misham Raya, you're bringing a proof from there. Meicher echel payers, all your lekeach. The moicher, in our scenario, Baisus himself continued to eat the payrus from that field during the time of the loan, not the lekeach. Now, how are they arguing on Metzius? So one possibility is that Rabbi Yehuda did not know who was eating the payrus, but he assumed usually when they make such arrangements, usually the lekeach is the one who's eating the payrus. So in this case, he assumed that's how it was, and the Chachamim are telling him no. As a matter of fact, in this case, it was moicher.
Saying that the day that the loan was up and he didn't pay, that's when he can take.
That's when he takes the field, right? My benayu. So what's the point of the machlokes between the Chachamim and Rabbi Yehuda? Why does Rabbi Yehuda allow it and the Chachamim not? Tzad echa beridus ikka benayu. Because they're arguing about this case of tzad echa beridus. Mar sava tzad echa beridus mutter. So Rabbi Yehuda holds it's allowed because again. It's not necessarily that there's going to be a ribis. If he ends up paying off the loan, then there's not going to be a ribis at all. So therefore, Rabbi Yehuda doesn't consider that to be ribis. Rabbi Nachmanan explains it differently. That the point is, the usual ribis involves that both sides, the loiva is giving ribis, the malva is receiving it. Here you really only have that one side is that one side has in other words, Rabbi Nachmanan explains it, relative to the lekeach, if he ends up paying off the field, then you have a problem of ribis. But relative to the moicher does not necessarily have to the moicher does not necessarily have to pay off the loan. He could default on the loan and the field ends up going to the other guy. He can't force the situation. Therefore, there may never be ribis at all. That's how Rabbi Nachmanan explains tzadech ribis. Anyway. So, Mar Savat Sadech Beribis Motor, Umar Savat Sadech Beribis Asim. So that's the Machloikas Rabbi Yehuda and the Chacham. So therefore, Rabbi Meir in our Mishnah is following the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda. That Sadech Beribis is Motor. So again, when you're selling the shul, not necessarily is the Tzibur going to be buying it back. So therefore, it's only one possibility that there's going to be Ribis, not another one. Or, according to Rabbi Hananel, again, the point is that only the Moicher, that only the Lekeach can force the issue, the Moicher can't. Therefore, even when you look at it from the point of view of the two parties, only one of them is even talking about a potential of this. So therefore, the mayor would hold, like Rabbi Yehuda, that is mutter. Rava gives a different explanation of the machlokes Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim. Dekula amat tzadech beribis oser. You could answer instead that both the Chachamim and Rabbi Yehuda agree that tzadech beribis is oser, but the nafkamina between them would be where there's ribis, but he's going to return it. So in other words, let's say in the case of the shul, yeah, if they do buy it back, then he's going to pay them rent for the time that he was living there. So mar sava ribis amanas lahasim moter mar sava osu. So therefore the mayor and the Yehuda would say it's allowed. The chacham would say it's not. Okay, we said in the mission of a chamer and Moshe Nois and Mimka over the fuller. The chum said you can sell the shul permanently. You don't have to make a tnai like your mayor says. But we said you're not allowed to sell it for any of the four things that we mentioned in the Mishnah. As a bathhouse, as a tannery, as a mikveh, or a beis hamayim. Where again, not yet two explanations what beis hamayim is. So the Gemara mentions in this connection a din that's going to tie back to what we said. Amr of Yehuda Amr Shmuel. A person is allowed to urinate within four amos of a place where he davened. In other words, so one second. What we mean is, in other words, if a person davened, let's say, for example, a person davened, you have to remember, in those days, they didn't have bathrooms in their houses. So let's say, for example, a person davened in their house. So afterwards, they would be allowed to go and urinate within four amos of the spot where they stood in order to daven. We don't say that place, once he davened there, has Grusha forever, and therefore that he can't. Amr Rabbi Yosef, Ma'ik HaMash Malan. So Rabbi Yosef says, what's the Chiddush? Tanena. We learned in our Mishnah. Rabbi Yehuda, Amr Meshu and Oysel HaShem HaChotzer. But Rabbi Yehuda says you're allowed to sell a shul as a chotzer. The Lekeach Mashayirtze Yasa. And the Lekeach will do with the property whatever he wants. Meaning that he's going to be even allowed, according to Rabbi Yehuda, to use it for one of these four things. Va'afilu Rabbanon like Ta'amri Elabes HaKinesis to Kriya Kushtei. Even the Chachamim who disagree are only talking about a shul, which has a permanent degree of Kedusha. Abel Dalan Amos, to like Kriya Kedusha Sayu, but the four Amos within you daven in your living room, that place doesn't have any particular Kedusha. Loi, so obviously not. So what's the Chiddush? Of course you should be allowed to. So the Gemara says, so the Gemara continues, Tony Tana Kameda Rav Nachman, a Tana taught a Braisa in front of Rav Nachman, Hamispalo Mach Dalet Amos Umashtin, when a person daven, he has to move away four Amos from there and then he can urinate. Bamashtin, Mach Dalet Amos Mispalo, and vice versa. If a person urinated, he has to move at least four Amos away from there in order to daven. Omale, so Rav Nachman says, I don't understand. I understand that if the urination came first, you have to move away four amos and daven. Tanena, because we learn in the Mishnah. How far away do you have to be from Meira Glayim or from Tsoya for Dal Amos in order to daven? You need to be four amos away. Really, by the way, technically what it is you need to be four amos away from where the smell ends. So we're talking about, for example, Meira Glayim that have no smell, then fine, you just need four amos. If they have an actual odor, then you need to move further away. Or whatever. So yeah, you has an odor. Right? Ella, but Reb Nachman says, how can you be saying in your Braisa, Hamispalo Mach Dal Amas Mashkin? He's saying that if a person davened in a certain place, then you have to move 4 amas away, and only then you can urinate. Normally, why would you need that? Ihochi Kedashim of the Cholish Tvila Din Nahar Dah. Then in that case, all the alleyways in Nahar Dah are going to have kedusha, because at one time or another, people stand there and daven, and you're not going to say that. So what does it mean? Tony, sort of Nachman, tells the Tana what you should learn in your Braisa, not that Marfik, not that you have to move away 4 amas, but Yat Yish, that after you finish davening, you should wait the time, the amount of time that it takes to walk 4 amas, and then if you have to urinate, then you do that.
You don't have to move away.
So the Gemara says, so both parts of the Braisa should be saying that. So the Gemara says, Bishleim mashtin yisha today hiloch dalet amas. Okay, so I can understand then, after a person urinated, he should wait a distance of at least 4 amas before he starts davening. I can understand. The Shemit Soit says, the reason is because of drops of urine that fell on his clothing, that at least they should get absorbed into his clothing before he starts for an answer. Why, after you daven for an asr, why would you need to wait the time of 4 amas before you urinate? And the answer is, Amar Ravashi, should call dalet amas tefilos yisdura b'fir. Because for the distance, for the amount of time that it takes to walk 4 amas, which is about 2 or 3 seconds, during that time, a person's tefila is still arranged in his mouth. His lips are still moving with the words of davening. So therefore, give a couple of seconds after you finish davening to stop saying the words of davening, and then you can go. Okay. So even though you went back 3 steps and all, yeah. Okay. So now the Gemara is going to bring in this connection, since we mentioned this idea of not urinating near where you're davening, or vice versa. So now the Gemara is going to bring where one of the Chachamim said that as a reason why he lived long. And the Gemara is going to bring now several Chachamim where they asked them, in what schus did you live long? And each of them mentions different things that they did. So Zalfon Simon, this is the Simon for the names of 4 Chachamim. So number one, Shalot Tamidus Eser Zakai, Bameher Rachti Yamin. Rav Zakai's Talmidim asked him, in what zchus did you live long? But Pashtus, this is not Zakai as in like father of Rav Yechanan and Zakai. This is somebody later. So Rav Yechanan is never called Rav Yechanan ben Reb Zakai. So Pashtus, his father was not necessarily a Talmud Chacham, but this Rav Zakai is from some later generation. Anyway, so Bameher Rachti Yamin, in what zchus did you live long? So he tells them, in all my life, I never urinated within 4 amas of tefillah, which means, in other words, now here we mean, Tosfos says, we mean the actual distance. Even though me'ikra din, you'd be allowed to, as we just said, once you wait the time of 4 amas, then you'd be allowed to, he would be machmir on himself and actually move 4 amas away from the spot where he had davened. I also never called my friends by a nickname, which means that Tosfos says, now, if it was a derogatory nickname, then that wouldn't be a chumrah. That's an ikra din. You're not allowed to. A person who calls another person by a derogatory name, ein lechelek on rabba. But here we're talking about where there's no gnai even, he wouldn't even do that. And the third thing he says, I was never a vato kiddush of the day, meaning even if I didn't have wine, I would never just make kiddush on bread or something. I would always have wine for kiddush. So the Gemara tells, he tells himself, Imas Kena Hoysali, I had an old mother, or Imas Kena, can also mean a grandmother, whatever. Pamachas, one time, we had no money in the house, but she realized that I really want wine for Kiddush. So Machra Kippa Shabarosha, she sold the cap that she wore on her head. And women used to wear, in those times, under their tichol or under their shetel, they would wear a kind of cap. So she sold that. Baby of the Kiddush Hayyan, and she brought me wine for Kiddush. So in the course of that, Tona, we learn in a Braisa, Kshemesa, when this mother or grandmother of Rav Zakai passed away, she had gotten richer, and she was so rich, she left for Rav Zakai as an inheritance 300 barrels of wine. Kshemeshu, and later on, when Rav Zakai himself passed away years later, he left for his descendants 3,000 barrels of wine. So Hashem gave them riches in the schus that they were so careful with the mitzvah of kiddush hayom, of making kiddush on wine and not. In fact, Tosfos refers to a Gemara in Shabbos that says exactly that. A person is careful with kiddush hayom, then he has the schus that he'll have barrels upon barrels of wine.
Okay.
So both of them did, but she did it because of him. That's why she had this chus that she left over some. And he was the cause of that mitzvah, because she only did it because she knew he's extra careful with it. Therefore, he had 10 times as much.
So the chus of making kiddush on grape juice is less than making it on wine?
No, but Pashtus, when we say wine, and usually when we say wine in Gemara, usually it includes grape juice as well. Practically speaking, they couldn't keep grape juice for very long. They didn't have pasteurization, so it would spoil unless they made it into wine. Lechora, we're talking about grape juice as well. All we mean is, as opposed to bread. You are allowed to make kiddush on bread, but it's a less preferable way of doing it. There is an Indian to use wine because it's more, it's more kosher. So, for example, I have a hard time with a full cup of wine for Kiddush, but so what I do is I use some wine and some grape juice. That way, there's no minimum alcohol content that it has to have in order to be considered wine. So like this, it has alcohol in it, but obviously if a person, for example, is a former alcoholic and has to swear off, wine, we're not talking about that. Let him make Kiddush on grape juice by all means, yeah.
How much wine and how much grape juice in proportion?
I don't know. I myself, you can use whatever proportion you want, I guess. I don't know. I usually use about one part wine and three, and then two or three parts grape juice.
I buy less. That's four.
Yeah, you buy a light wine. You buy a 4 or 5% alcohol wine. Yeah, you can do that too. Yeah.
Apparently they have money for
basic food. It's not for wine. Yeah. Okay.
Earlier when you said you didn't call anybody by quinoa, is it quinoa like? His name is Yosef. You call him Yossi or Avremo? Is that a kinui?
The Pashtus, that's not what we mean by a kinui. The Pashtus, a kinui means more like a nickname for somebody like Shorty or whatever, or even, okay, we're saying not a shame gnai, but something like a nickname, but not some derogatory. But still. Yeah, let's say that.
But let's say there was a person in Dashba, and then there was everybody understands it's not a gnai.
Okay, but even so, I guess you're exactly, we're still careful about that. Okay. So the Gemara gives another example of somebody who was extra careful with the mitzvah of Kiddush and had a schus because of that. The Gemara says, Rav Huna have osa risa. Rav Huna one time had a risa around his waist. It actually says risa is a kind of grass. So like he made a rope out of grass and was wearing it as a belt around his waist instead of a normal belt. V'koy kameh de Rav. He's standing in front of Rav as a Talmud to learn Torah. Omale mai hai, so Rav asked him, why are you wearing a grass belt? Omale, so Rav Huna tells him, loy havale kiddusha, I didn't have wine for kiddush, or mashkante lehem yinoi, so I pawned my belt in order to get money. Vasai be kiddusha, and I used the money to buy wine for kiddush. Omale, so Rav tells him, yehei rabba de titum vishiroi, may it be Hashem's will that one day you'll be covered with silk clothing. So what happened? So many years passed. Rav Huna eventually became rich. Ki ichlal Rabba braids Rav Huna. When Rabba, the son of Rav Huna, was getting married, now Rav Huna inish gutsa. Ki ichlal Rabba braid. When Rabba, his son, years later, was getting married, now Rav Huna inish gutsa hava. Rav Huna was a short person, so gun apuya. He was lying down on a bed there, sometimes someplace in or near the chasna hall. Asin bnosev kalose. His daughters and his daughters-in-law came into the room. Shochan, they took off the Shadian Manayu Ale, and they were throwing their clothes on him. He was sleeping on the bed, but he was short, so they didn't notice him in the bed. And the stomach was like half dark in there. So they took off their coats, which were made out of silk, and threw them on the bed. Adi Itum Vishiroi. So literally when he woke up, he was covered with silk clothes. So the bracha was actually Niskayim. Shama Rav, so when Rav heard about this, the Ikbad, he was makbid, he was upset with Rav Huna. Omar, my time, since obviously when I gave you the bracha, it was obviously an ace rotzen for the bracha to be niskayim, why didn't you tell me when I gave you the bracha, v'chein lamar, and the same thing for you, Rebbe. And then the bracha, then I would have had such a bracha as well. So we learn from that. This is where we learn the concept that when somebody benches you, so you bench him back in order that this way, if it is in fact an ace rotzen, then that way the bracha will be makoyim for the other person as well.
You could have said it at that time, like years later.
Well, that's what he said. So at the time, well, Rav didn't know at the time that it was an Aesirot. And only years later, when he saw that the bracha was the sky, and now he said, in retrospect, Rav Huna, you should have told me v'chein lamar.
Is there a bracha to have a bunch of people so close?
Well, the point is, in other words, that he was rich. The point is, how do his daughters and daughters-in-law come to have silk clothing? Obviously, it means that he came into money.
He
we find in other places in Shas, we find in other places in Shas that Rabbuna did become quite wealthy. So when he was younger, he was poor. We have this example, we have other examples in the Gemara, but eventually he became rich. So yeah.
So
therefore, he should have right away said l'chein l'marin. Yeah, exactly. So another example, another case. So we had Rav Zakkai. We had with a chamim, where his talmidim asked him b'meher achi yamin. So here's another one. Shaul talmidim was Rav Elazar ben Shamua b'meher achi yamin. Rav Elazar ben Shamua, by the way, he was one of the Asar Arugim Malchus. One of the Midrashim on it says that he was 105 at the time. So he obviously was Marif Yamin. So 105 is a pretty advanced age. So with what schus did you live long? Amalehem, so he tells them, Miyomai lo yasisi kapadaria le beis medrash. In all my life, I never used, or basic nessus, whatever, I never used the shul or the beis medrash as a shortcut. Now, mi'ikra din, you're not allowed to. But there are actually cases where you are. For example, let's say you went in there to daven, then you're allowed to leave by the other entrance. So he, apparently, the idea was he was machmed even on that. Also, for example, you have a din, let's say, I think we're going to have it later on in our parak, that, for example, if there was a path there before the shul was built, then you're allowed to continue using that pathway. Nevertheless, he was machbid not to do that. Number two, we're like, asaiti al roshe am todesh, I never stepped over the heads of the holy people, meaning Rashi describes the Talmidim are sitting in the Mismedesh on the floor. So now, he would always make sure he's never going to be late, such that he would have to be walking over their heads, because it wouldn't be derech eretz to them. So therefore, he would always make sure to be there before the Talmidim come. And again, there are cases where you're allowed to, but nevertheless, he was machmir on himself not to. And I never duchen without a bracha. Rav Elazar ben Shamua was a kohen. Now, what's the chiddush that he didn't duchen, that he always duchen with a bracha? I mean, you have to say No, to duchen. To actually go up to the duchen, he always made sure to say the bracha asher kedushanu b'tishasei sh'aretz. So the question is, a bunch of them, the Mefarshim asks, so what's the chiddush? Of course, the kohen has to say the bracha. So Maharsha says maybe because you could argue that Birkas Kohenim itself it's a prerequisite sort of. The mitzvah is you're benching, the Kohenim are benching the Yidden in order that Hashem should bench them. So you could argue maybe such a thing doesn't require a bracha. Nevertheless, he held that it does and he said a bracha. The Turei Evin says maybe what it was is maybe Rav Elazar ben Shamua was the one who was actually in the sack in the bracha. Maybe before that, the Chachamim held that you don't need a bracha for Birkas Kohenim. And one reason for that could be al derech life. We know, for example, you don't make a bracha for Birkas HaMazon, even though Birkas HaMazon itself is a mitzvah in the Torah, but you don't make a bracha that you have the chance to say another bracha. So before Rav Elazar ben Shamua, they may have held that way, that you don't make a bracha for Birkas Kohenim. And he was the one who was masakin the bracha. And then there's a couple of other explanations, one of them being that maybe technically one kohen could say the bracha and everybody else could be yotze, but he was machmed to actually say the bracha himself rather than just rely on somebody, on one of the other kohenim saying the bracha. Asher kedushanu b'kedushasei shel Aaron is how the bracha goes. That Hashem made us holy with the kedusha of Aaron. Tzivanu levarach chacham Yisrael
ba'ar. Tzivanu came, it was about 500 earlier. Then.
That's the point. Birkas kohenim is a mitzvah in the Torah. It's one of the 613 mitzvahs. But the idea is, the Turei Evin wants to say that maybe previously there was no concept of saying a bracha on it, just like, for example, there's no concept of saying a bracha before benching. But then Rav Elazar ben Shamua was misakin. The Turei Evin says maybe he was the one who was actually misakin the bracha that Adayim Azeh the Kohenim said. Yeah. Okay, so we'll continue tomorrow, Beis Hashem, with other ones, with other Chachamim, where their Talmidim asked them in what schus did they live long, and we'll talk about those.
Regarding Birkas Kohanim, how can they make a bracha when they're not even certain that they're Kohanim? It could be considered bracha l'batala, basically.
They have a chazakah of being Kohanim, and chazakah is a powerful enough thing that they're allowed to.
They don't have a chazakah. There's a suffix.
No. We have those Kohanim. No. Listen. There's Kohanim Yichus and there's Kohanim Chazakah. It's true we don't have any Kohanim Yichus nowadays, namely ones who have documentary evidence that they trace back to Kohanim. It's true. But they are Kohanim Chazakah. People who are assumed to be Kohanim now, they have just that. They have a Chazakah that they are Kohanim. For certain purposes, that wouldn't be enough. For example, to serve in the Mismikdash, they need more than that. So when Mashiach comes, then he will clarify all of that. But for purposes of Birkas Kohanim, for example, Chazakah is a powerful thing in Halacha. We see, for example, that Chazakah is even enough. For example, the Gemara in Cholin has a whole sugya about it. For example, we see that Chazakah is enough to be able to eat meat. You don't say, for example, what if the animal had a hole in its windpipe at exactly the place where you shafted it? Nevertheless, we say you're allowed to eat meat. The same way we say there's a lot of examples the Gemara brings over there, where chazaka, where we accept chazaka as a valid thing in halakha. So the same way over here, the chazaka is enough for the kohen to be able to say that bracha. That's it. That the fact that they have a chazaka that they're kohen.
But technically, they should have three generations, so they should have three generations above them who are kohanim to have a chazaka.
No, no. First of all, they do. First of all, kohanim do. They know how does the person know that he's a kohen? Because his father was a kohen, because his grandfather was a kohen, etc. But chazaka for this purpose doesn't necessarily require three generations. It just means that he has a chazaka, that he has a known family tradition that he is a kohen. That's good enough for purposes. Again, it won't allow him to serve in the mishmish. It won't allow him to eat truma daraisa. But to do things like this, it'll allow it to. The truth is, by the way, the Rishonim talk about the possibility, based on a Gemara and Shabbos, that even if non-Koyan, even if a Zor does Duchen, it's possible that he's only over on a mitzvah saseh. Because after all, the Pasuk says, Kosa Baruch Hu as Bnei Yisrael, that the Koyanim should bless the Jewish people, implying Koyanim yes, Zorim no. So therefore, if a Zor does it, the most that he's doing is over on a mitzvah saseh, say a couple of Rishonim. So that being the case, that's all the more reason why the Koyanim can do it and don't have to worry about, and they can say and once they're allowed to do it, then they're allowed to say the Bracha as well on the basis of their Chazaka of the
Mm-hmm.
Okay.